Did anybody not get a copy of the exercises?
I was here.
Okay.
Oh.
And also, this is just for your reference. It's all a little different. You can write them all down.
Did everybody get this to rules of inference? Okay. Today I want to just finish up looking at these rules of inference and consider a few things here. And then we're going to go back and work on these same problems that we've had. And if we've got time, we'll get to the new one. I think what we'll basically do for the rest of the time on logic, we'll get as far as we can today with some of these things. And there's a few other things I want to lecture about. I may have to take next Wednesday off from Isaiah again, or the next when we come back from break. And I expect we'll probably take two more sessions, Wednesday and Thursday. I'll have a few more things to wrap up, and we'll work in class on some of these problems and make sure that everybody is following things basically. And I think Don's going to begin after that, but we'll probably have our quiz sometime after Don begins. So the quiz, don't worry about a test coming up immediately. We've got a few more things to do the next session after break, and then there'll be a quiz coming up. And like I said, I think we'll probably have a quiz dealing with the problems in class, an open book. You'll have everything available, and it'll be a matter of working some of these problems. Okay. Now, as I left off in my lecture last time, we were talking about these rules of inference and the method of deduction. And we found that one way to prove the validity of an argument that will save a lot of time, you see, I think, you know, when you get to some of these with eight rows, and there was one of those that on your worksheet you probably didn't get to yet with 16, you can see that once you get an argument like the one we had with the railroad men, I don't know how many variables you'd have there, but you'd have a truth table. You know, you'd probably have to, you know, carry in with a truck or something at some of these, and it'd be very laborious. I mean, you could figure it out that way if you wanted to, but it would take a long time. Or you could get a computer to do that. A computer would do these things very nicely. But another way to do it is to break the problem down into simpler form and to use some rules of inference, which are nothing more than valid arguments themselves, at least these first nine, to break a more complex problem down and to work with it. Okay, and one example we gave you last time, using various steps to come up with a conclusion, each of those steps themselves being valid arguments. Now, I've given you a list here. You may want to take a look at that now rather than try to write this all down again. This list of the rules of inference, and you see the first nine here. They're really in two sections. There's the first nine and then the last ten. We'll talk about those last ten here today also. But the first are a series of smaller valid arguments. Notice the first one here called modus ponens, which is our good old P horseshoe Q, P, therefore Q. And if P, then Q, you see, and if P is true, then that means Q has to be true. So this is a valid argument. And you can prove this by a truth table. And I think we've already done that somewhere along the line. Number two is modus tollens. This is P horseshoe Q, not Q, therefore not P. This is also a valid argument. And we've already seen a couple of fallacies that that look superficially like this. For example, for modus ponens, the first one, P horseshoe Q, and then if a person says Q and tries to infer P from that, that doesn't work. That turns out to be not valid. But it looks superficially like the other. and from modus tollens, P horseshoe Q, and then putting not P and therefore getting not Q, that doesn't work either. In fact, that particular kind of fallacy is the fallacy that's often used in these arguments concerning the Holy Spirit and person. If the Holy Spirit dwells in you, then he'll raise you from the dead. And then a person inferring from that that if the Holy Spirit doesn't dwell in you, then you won't be saved, you won't be raised from the dead. It doesn't follow. Because you negating the premise does not necessarily negate the conclusion of an implication like this. Remember when we saw our definition for P horseshoe Q, well, just looking at it right here, the only way it's false is if you've got a true premise and a false conclusion. And it's true even when the premise is false, the implication is true. In other words, you cannot conclude a false conclusion just because the premise there happens to be false or negated or something. Yeah. 15. Yeah, it's related to that. It's related to that. Actually, that 15 is really connected with this modus tollens up here and the negations, and you see it works in a different direction. This is a rule of replacement, so it's a little bit different type of situation, but it's derived from the same problem, same connection. Okay, number 3 is hypothetical syllogism. That's one we used on one example I gave you last time. That's P horseshoe Q, Q horseshoe R, therefore P horseshoe R. This is a very useful one when you're doing long proofs because you can eliminate a term. For example, see the Q there, you can eliminate that and come up with P horseshoe R from these other two, and then you can go on from there. And so it's a very useful thing, especially when you're dealing with proofs there, to eliminate a middle term. Okay, we already verified that with the truth table. Number 4, the disjunctive syllogism. We talked about that. And these symbols, DS, those are for use on your proof line, so you don't have to write this all out. It's best to use the abbreviations. A disjunctive syllogism, P or Q, not P, therefore Q. Okay, and then number 5, constructive dilemma. P horseshoe Q and R horseshoe S, and then P or R results in Q or S. Number 6, absorption. That's P horseshoe Q, therefore P horseshoe P and Q. This is absorption. In other words, if P implies Q, then P is also going to imply P and Q. Because if P is true, then P is true, you see. And so when you conjoin it to that other, you can still come up with the same thing. You can verify that with the truth table also. This is a convenient one sometimes, too, and in getting certain types of terms. From P horseshoe Q, you can get this P dot Q term, which in a long proof may be able to be substituted for some other things and enable you to get some work done. You'll see how it works as you get into it. Then almost the opposite of that, in a sense, is simplification, number 7. P and Q, therefore P. Now, that should follow from the truth table. From the truth table, the only way P and Q can be true is if both P and Q are true. Therefore, P has to be true, see? So if you know that P and Q is true, then you obviously know that P is true. Now, actually, you also know that Q is true, too, from that. But they define it a certain way, and then there's other rules for reversing things and getting the other part of it. Okay, and then conjunction. P, Q, therefore P dot Q. If you know P is true and you know Q is true, then you know P dot Q is true because P dot Q is just P and Q. And it's just summarizing that statement. And then addition, this is another convenient one. P, your only premise is P, therefore P or Q, and Q can be anything. In other words, if you know that one statement is true, you can add any statement of any kind, true or false, any bizarre statement that you want to make, no matter how ridiculous it might be, and the statement that P or Q is true will still be true since the P part was true. So that's all it's saying there. So you can add any kind of statement in a disjunction like that if you know one of the statements is true and still have a true statement. Okay, you might wonder why would you ever want to do that. But in some cases in proofs you might want to because you might want to choose the particular Q that fits someplace else and then you'll have a term now that you can use and draw some other connections with. So there is a use for this. Okay, Mark? Well, go ahead and explain what sense you mean. Not sure if I quite...
Now, when there are, you know, P or Q,
Oh, yeah, I suppose you could do it that way, yeah. And as long as you got one of them already established as true, you can stick almost anything ridiculous on the side of it, still have something true. Okay, so those are the nine rules, basic first nine rules of inference, but we've got some others down here from 10 and following that we haven't really talked about yet. So I wanted to say a few things before we look at these last 10, these rules of replacement. Now, as it turns out, as useful as these first nine rules are, there are many valid arguments whose validity cannot be proved using only those nine. There are some valid arguments that you can't prove with those nine statements, and you need some additional rules. Now, you could still prove them with a truth table or something, but our object here is to try to simplify things. And so there have been some other rules that have been developed in order to meet some of these weaknesses. Now, as we saw earlier in our last discussion, two statements that are logically equivalent function exactly the same logically. Remember, our definition of logical equivalence was when you have a material equivalence between them is a tautology, always true. And what that means essentially is that their truth tables are identical. If you've got two statements that are logically equivalent, the truth tables of those statements are identical. That means that, and since logic functions on the basis of these truth tables, the truth tables tell you how this thing functions in a logical way. If the truth tables are identical, then the statements are logically identical. And that means then that if we have two statements that are logically identical to each other, that if we have an argument in which one of the statements occurs, we could just as easily pull that statement out and put the other one in its place, and we would not have changed anything in the argument as far as its logical conclusion and its validity and so forth is concerned. And so this gives us a means of replacing one term with another term that's logically equivalent to it. And in doing so, we're not going to change the logic of the argument, but we may make it easier to use these other principles and rules of inference to come up with a decision as to whether it's valid or not. And so this is the essence of this rule of replacement. Really, we can infer from any statement the result of replacing any component of that statement by another statement logically equivalent to the component replaced. That's fancy language, but what it means is if we've got a statement in an argument, we can yank that statement out and put another statement in that's logically equivalent to it and not change the argument at all, although it may make it easier for us to solve some things out because of it. And this only works because of the logical equivalence of these two statements. You can't just pull any statement out and put any old statement in. If you do, you're liable to change the whole thing. But if you replace any statement with a logically equivalent statement, then you haven't really changed the argument. And that can be true about, say you've got a big long statement, you can take part of that statement out and put another part that's logically equivalent to it in its place and not change the meaning of the whole statement. Or you can take a whole line, for example, in an argument, a whole premise, and find another statement that's logically equivalent to it and just replace them and still not change the argument. So this turns out to be very, very convenient. Now, we can list then a number of tautologous biconditionals. Remember, the biconditional was the equal sign with three bars on it. And a biconditional that is tautologous is what we mean by being logically equivalent. This material equivalence or biconditional, if that is a tautologous statement, then those two statements are identical logically. Now, we'll list then a number of these that turn out to be tautologous biconditionals, and they form these rules of replacement. They tell us what terms we can swap with other terms and not change the logic of the argument. And so, if you look at your sheet here, these are the last 10 of these rules of inference. We've added these now to the first 9, and these are rules of replacement. They're different than the above ones, you see, because in the above ones, we have each one of the first 9 is a little argument by itself. These statements aren't arguments, they're just equivalent terms that you can swap in and out of other statements. And so the first of these is number 10, De Morgan's theorems. We looked at this before. Not P and Q is equivalent to not P or not Q. Some of these aren't really obvious by looking at them, but when you work through the truth tables, you'll see that they are. In fact, the less obvious they are, sometimes the more useful they are in making substitutions and so forth. And then another part of De Morgan's theorem is not P or Q is equivalent to not P and not Q. And you can show by truth tables that these two statements are logically equivalent and that they function exactly the same logically. So, if I have some sort of an expression with the term not P and Q, somewhere in my statement I have not P and Q, what this tells me is, say if I've got this horseshoe R, something like that, what this tells me is I can take this not P and Q term here, there's a parenthesis around the thing, I can take that whole term and exchange it and put not P or not Q, horseshoe R, and I've got the same statement. But this may lend itself in whatever particular argument I'm dealing with to another simplification if I see another parallel structure, and then I can do something with this and make it simpler in the long run. And you know, you're not always, it's not a game of just substituting indiscriminately. Whenever you want to substitute, you should have a motive for doing it, and it should make that expression look better like another argument and so forth that you can apply a step to and work with. You see, this is just like mathematics. If you know anything about algebra, this is really the very same thing. It's the same as geometry also, just a little bit different framework. The rule number 11 is commutation. This just means reversing the terms. P or Q is equivalent to Q or P. In other words, whichever term you put first doesn't change the truth table of these statements. And, of course, that should be pretty self-evident. Same as P dot Q is equivalent to Q dot P. So you can reverse the terms in a conjunction or a disjunction without changing it. Now notice, it didn't say P horseshoe Q is equivalent to Q horseshoe P, because it doesn't work with that one. You can't commute the implication. But you can with the conjunction and disjunction. You can reverse the terms and not change it. Okay. Then number 12, association. Here we have P or the term Q or R is equivalent to P or Q or R. In other words, the disjunction can be associated. You can bracket these parentheses around the different terms and separate them out. This one's real useful many times in getting the two terms that you want together. And same is true with the conjunction. P dot the term Q dot R is equivalent to P dot Q dot R. So in each case, you've got all the same terms, but you're grouping them differently. And in this case, grouping them won't affect. But again, you can't do this with a horseshoe. You can't do this with the same. You can't have P horseshoe Q horseshoe R is equivalent to P horseshoe Q or horseshoe R. It just doesn't work that way. You get into real trouble when you do that. Okay. Distribution. P dot Q or R is equivalent to P dot Q or P dot R. This reminds you of things that you see in the algebra also, where you're multiplying a term with two terms added together, like let's say C times A plus B is equal to C times A plus C times B. See, it's very, very, very same thing. And it works also with the conjunction, or it works with the disjunction, I should say, applied to the conjunction. P or Q dot R is equivalent to P or Q dot P or R. And those things, again, if you don't believe these, any of these, just work the truth table out and see how it lines up. Like I say, some things may not be intuitively obvious, but you can check them and verify them. Okay, number 14, the double negation. P is equivalent to not, not P. So that's just a simple statement of the fact that a statement is either true or false, and if you negate the negation of a statement, you're going to get the statement back again. Now, if you're in Greek grammar, this doesn't work, but in logic it does. All right. Number 15, transposition. P horseshoe Q is equivalent to not Q horseshoe not P. So you can, this is somewhat analogous to our commutation, number 11 there, where you're reversing the terms, but with an implication, you've got to negate them before you can reverse them. So you can reverse them, but they become both negated. That's the only thing you can draw from that. You can't reverse them in their positive, or you get trouble. Yeah? I'm not sure if other books may classify it that way, but yeah, it seems a logical term for it. I haven't heard that word applied to it, but yeah, transposition. Is the term you'll normally see. These are pretty standardized, abbreviations and things that you'll see in most all logic textbooks. Number 16, material implication, just abbreviated IMPL. We have P horseshoe Q is equivalent to not P or Q. Not P or Q. That was one of the first ones we looked at. We looked at that when we were defining material implication. Number 17, material equivalence. That's really the basis for all of these things, but P is equivalent to Q, or is the same as saying P horseshoe Q and Q horseshoe P. That's the biconditional. Both terms imply each other, and that's what it essentially means to say P is equivalent to Q. It means if P is true, then Q is true, and if Q is true, then P is true. If P is false, then Q is false, and if Q is false, then P is false. You see, it's stating that both of those terms must be either true or false. They agree with each other. Okay, so they're logically equivalent. Then also it can be defined as, in the next line, P is equivalent to Q is the famous saying, P dot Q or not P dot not Q. Okay, so the point is saying that either both are true or both are false. That's really what it's saying. Either P and Q are both true, or not P and not Q are both true, which means that Q and P are both false. So it's saying they're either both true or they're both false. Now notice that the equal signs here have a slightly different significance. The P is equivalent to Q is defining the material equivalence, and this whole statement is actually a tautology. In other words, all of these are actually tautologies, and they become logical equivalents because of the whole structure of what we're talking about here. So the fact that that statement is a tautology makes this, it takes more than just drawing a material equivalence between two terms, in other words, to guarantee that they're logically equivalent. You can draw a material equivalence, and you might find that that material equivalence is false in some cases. And in that case, those statements won't be logically equivalent. It's only when they're tautologies, it's always true that you have a logical equivalent. Okay, then number 18, exportation. We have P dot Q horseshoe R is equivalent to P horseshoe Q horseshoe R. That, again, is one that may not be immediately obvious, but you can check it out. And it does become very, very convenient in working problems. And then the tautology, and here tautology is used in a slightly different sense than it's been used before. Tautology is defined here as P is equivalent to P or P. That should make some sense. I mean, you might wonder why you should put that down, but it certainly is true. And P is equivalent to P and P. Okay. Now, there are reasons for doing that sometimes in substitutions and in a more complex problem. So you can get a term like P or P and then use maybe something like association on that. And get other terms lined up together that you can apply other things to. So there really are reasons for doing that, even though you might wonder, obviously, if P is true, then P or P is true. And if P is true, then P and P is true. It doesn't seem to make any sense to say that, except that you'll see that in using these other rules, that rule wouldn't make any sense at all if it weren't used in conjunction with other things that can get you different groupings and work some more complex problems. Okay, now just a few general comments. These 19 rules are somewhat redundant, actually. As it turns out, not all of them are needed. You can define some of the rules in terms of other rules, and so you could knock this list down by a few if you wanted to. But to do that would make a little bit more work. This turns out to be a very convenient list, even though some of the steps are somewhat redundant. You could deduce some of these arguments from others. Still, in doing a complex argument, these are the fastest ways to do it. Otherwise, you'd have to use two or three steps, and where you could use one by these rules. And so you can get some of the rules from others, but for convenience of working proofs, these turn out to be the most convenient and the quickest. Now, constructing proofs with these rules isn't always easy. It isn't just a matter of pure mechanics. You have to do some thinking. The truth table method is purely mechanical. You just put out all the figures here and then you just go through and work it out. You don't have to even really think to do the truth table method, as long as you just follow the rules, and then you'll end up with the answer. But it may take you a long, long time. And so these other rules of inference are really devised to save you some work. And mankind has been very, very good at finding ways of saving work. And that's really what this all amounts to. But it takes some ingenuity sometimes. You know, you see a big long proof, and it's not always obvious which steps to use and which way to work to proceed in the thing, and it takes a little bit of insight. Sometimes you'll be working through, and you'll be stumbling with the thing, and you can't see what it is, and then the light turns on, and a certain couple of steps become obvious as to how to work this into another form, and then you can solve the thing through. So it's just like a geometry problem or something. Theoretically, the answer is guaranteed once the problem's set up, but to actually work it out is sometimes another story. And so constructing these proofs isn't always easy, but it is much faster than the purely mechanical way, even if it does take a while in some cases. Now, there is also a difference between the first 9 and the last 10 of these rules. The rules of replacement are a little bit different than the first 9 in that, with the first 9 rules, because they're really smaller arguments, you have to deal with a whole line, a whole premise at a time. You can't just apply the rules of inference, these first 9 rules, to a part of a line. But you can with the substitution rule. Let me just illustrate what I mean by this. Let's take, for example, a statement. A dot B. Now, from A dot B, we have that statement. Our rule of simplification, number 7 on your list there, where we have P dot Q, therefore P. We can deduce from this A dot B, therefore A, from number 7, from simplification. However, let's suppose we have A dot B, horseshoe B. Let's suppose we have that statement as one of our lines. Now, a person might look at this and say, well, maybe then I could deduce A horseshoe C, because I could take A dot B, therefore A, from this part, and then just substitute that term into this and end up with this statement, but that won't work. That won't work. The fact that you've got A dot B horseshoe C does not necessarily imply A horseshoe C at all. And so you can't apply these first 9 rules to just a part of a term. You have to apply it to the whole line. In this case, A dot B is the whole line. In this case, A dot B is only the antecedent to a conditional. And I can't just take this out and substitute this in because of this argument. You have to follow the whole terms. In other words, when you're using one of the first 9 rules, you've got to make sure that you're applying those rules to the total premises and the total line, not just to parts of them. However, the rules of replacement, I can stick in just even part of an argument. In other words, for example, if I take this A dot B horseshoe C here as my premise, by a rule of replacement, I can take this term A dot B and get B dot A by commutation and horseshoe C by commutation and be perfectly justified in doing that, because this term is logically equivalent to this term. If I yank this thing out, it's logically equivalent to this term. It's going to function exactly the same in the truth table. Whereas in my previous analogy here, or example, A dot B is not logically equivalent to A. I can deduce A from A dot B, but it's not logically equivalent. So I can't just pull A dot B out of some part and substitute A in there. It won't work. I may change the whole logical structure of my statement if I do that, because if you try to draw a truth table between A and A dot B, they're not going to be the same. However, B dot A is going to have the exact same truth table as A dot B, and so they're going to function logically identically, and I can do this and not change this, the nature of this implication or anything else. So that's just something to remember when you're applying these rules. The replacement rules can be applied any place. Wherever you see a term, even if it's in the middle of a big long line, you can apply it. But the first 9 rules, you can't do that. You've got to look at the whole statement and apply the rule in that way, not just to a part of the statement. Now, those first terms can be applied in a little bit more complex way sometimes, where you have a repeated term, and you can, for example, let's suppose I have something like A dot B horseshoe B dot B, and then I say A horseshoe B. From this, I can deduce C horseshoe D by modus ponens, because by modus ponens, I can look at this whole term as being T, and this whole term as being Q. And since this term is exactly the same as this one, I have another P here, and therefore I can infer Q. Because the terms are consistent all the way through here. In other words, I've got this term and then this term, and they're really, it's A dot B, but it's still the whole term here. I can, since the term's repeated in exactly the same way, I can do this. However, I couldn't use modus ponens if I had, say, for example, this is my next premise, A horseshoe B. Then I'm out of luck. I got to do something else because I don't have the exact same term here anymore. This would have to be called R or something, you see. And so it wouldn't work. Yeah.
Maybe that it's like a Q and B or
right, yeah. It's not going to matter what function's inside here either. See, I could do the same thing with this or this. Now, see, if I've got this, then I can conclude it's C or D. Because my P statement is consistent both places here. I've got C twice. That's getting a little bit more refined here. I hope I haven't confused you by saying this, but when you're looking at your application of your first rules, what you're looking for is consistency in terms that you can use together. And even though a term may be long, if that's one thing to watch for in your long proofs. If you see a complex term that's repeated several times in several statements, then you can symbolize that by a simpler term and treat it all as one unit until you get down to a place where you want to break that down further, and you may be able to eliminate some other terms in the course of things and so forth. Okay. Let's see. Conclusion to this, and we're not completely done, there's one more area I want to talk about next time we meet, and that is a simpler way to prove invalidity, to prove an argument's not valid. You can see these rules will help you prove an argument is valid, but what happens when you're working and slaving away and the argument turns out to be not valid and you're trying to find a proof for its validity, and you're grinding your brain out and you find out that the reason you can't get an answer is because it's invalid. But it's hard to tell whether the argument's really invalid or if you've just been making mistakes and you haven't come to the right answer. So we're going to look next time at a way that you can find out if an argument's invalid real quick. And it'll save you some time and to find out if it's invalid. Now, that won't necessarily give you the way to prove that it is valid, but if you get some big, ugly argument, you might want to find out for sure whether it's valid or not before you try to prove its validity. In other words, you can find out whether it is, or if you can show, there's a quick way to test and find that it is invalid, that it doesn't work, and we'll do that. It's related to the truth table method, but it's much, much simpler. We'll talk about it next time. But for now, I just want to say a few general comments about the procedure in constructing these proofs to give you some guidelines as to how to tackle a big problem. The first thing to do is to begin deducing conclusions from given premises by the rules of inference. Look at your first 9 rules and see places where you can begin to draw obvious conclusions from the premises that are given there. And so if you see something like a P horseshoe Q and a Q horseshoe R someplace in those columns, then by disjunctive or by hypothetical syllogism, you can get P horseshoe R and eliminate a term thing. So look first at what's obvious. Look first at the things where you can see some clear premises that you can line up by one of these rules and draw a conclusion. And start drawing all those conclusions that you can by those means. And then you can start working with those conclusions and maybe applying the same things over again. Now, don't feel that when you look at something, it's going to be obvious what the answer is, you know. Unless you're a super genius or something, it's going to take some time to start piecing these things together. Also, try to eliminate statements that occur in the premises but not in the conclusion. In other words, if you've got premises that have got all kinds of statements, say in your conclusion you only had a P and a Q, but in your premises you had R's and S's and P's and all kinds of other things too. What you would try to do is work toward eliminating terms that aren't found in the conclusion, trying to get them out of there somehow. And rules like simplification are helpful there. We've got P and Q. Let's suppose that in your premises you had a statement like P and Q and R and S or something, and in your conclusion all you had P's and Q's. By simplification, you can get rid of some of those. P and Q implies P. So you can knock the Q out of there for another statement. You know that P is true, and if you can conjoin them with something else, you may eliminate some terms and get things down to a real simple form. Okay. Also, the hypothetical syllogism, as I mentioned here, is another good way for dropping out middle terms. If you see here, number 3, P horseshoe Q, Q horseshoe R, therefore P horseshoe R. Notice that your conclusion now has eliminated the term Q. And now you don't even need to worry about Q. All you've got is P and R, and that'll eliminate a term. Okay. You can also sometimes use distribution to get conjunctions. For example, and then you can drop one half of that by simplification. For example, let's take a statement P or Q or R. By distribution, we can deduce from this P or Q dot P or R. And now by simplification, this is by distribution. And now by simplification, I can drop one in term of the other. See, if I got P or Q and P or R, therefore P or Q. And now I've got P or Q and I don't have R anymore. I've eliminated R from that. And now I can just work with P or Q and two terms. And if my conclusion only has P's and Q's, then now I've at least been getting closer to my conclusion. And then if I'm looking at some other premises and I've got some other statements here, if I, from some other conclusions, have found out that Q is true, for example, then I can conclude P, something like that, you see. Or no, excuse me, not if I find out that not Q is true, if I find out not Q from some other line of reasoning, then I can conclude P, something like that, you see. So that's the way you'll try to work and try to eliminate terms. These are just general things now, just to give you hints as to how to look at some things and how to try to break them down. Also, another thing that you can do sometimes is to try to work backward from the conclusion. You know, if you know the argument's valid, for example, you can start working backward from the conclusion and seeing if that will lead to anything. In other words, you can look at the conclusion. You can see now this conclusion could be deduced from, if your conclusion is Q or S, for example, you can use the constructive dilemma. You know that you could get Q or S if you had P horseshoe Q dot R horseshoe S and P horseshoe R. And so you can start to look and see if you can get those other terms somehow by combining the other things. And if you get those, then you can get the thing you're looking for. So some of it involves just looking at what your conclusion is and what kinds of arguments will give you that kind of conclusion and see if you can get somehow derive those middle terms that will get you the conclusion. Of course, sometimes you've got step after step after step, you know, and I'm not going to give you such complex ones that it's going to take you forever to figure out by any means. But those are some suggestions as to how to proceed. Okay, any questions on this as far as we've gone?
Any questions about the theory?
Okay.
I didn't understand how you came from P42 to the parentheses and P42R, I guess, to Q.
Oh, okay. Okay, let's put it on. Just this very last one I had, this one. I might have written wrong. That's what I should have written. That's probably what happened. From this, you can get P or Q dot P or R. Yeah, I think I may have put a disjunction there. That would make it, it doesn't work. Okay. Yeah, that's what I meant. And from that, then you can deduce either half of this from simplification. So in this case, I would take Q or Q, the one I wanted. If I wanted to eliminate Q, I'd just take this half. Well, my conclusion only has P or R, I can get P or R from this too. Let's say by the same rule. Now, technically, what I'd have to do, since your simplification rule is stated P dot Q, therefore P, in order to reverse this, what you could do is, if I wanted to get this one instead of this one, I would just do this, P or R dot P or Q. How am I going to be able to determine that? What's that? There was one rule. In other words, this is just like saying P or Q, P dot Q, therefore Q dot P.
Commutation.
Yeah, commutation. By commutation, and now I can put P or R by simplification. Okay. That's just because of the way the rule is written. And so you need to reverse the terms, get the one that you're looking for first, and then use the rule as it is. Okay. Questions? Okay. Yeah. In fact, that's one of the problems that we have in the exercises here. And I think in the time that we have remaining, I want to look at some of these exercise problems. And how far did you get yesterday. I think with Mark said you got a lot of these first ones done. I didn't really expect you to get all these done, by the way. So don't be serious. It takes to write those two tables out. You know, even if you can figure it all out, it takes a certain amount of time and labor to write those things out. So don't be at all discouraged if you didn't get all the way through it. I didn't expect you to. The reason I gave you so many problems is so that you can have fun with these on your own sometime, you know, if you want to do more, just for exercise purposes. But on the top of page 2, let's look at this together and work it on the board. Let's work problem number 1. Now, the main thing to watch when you're dealing with verbal problems, it doesn't really matter a whole lot what symbol you use for a statement. But what matters is making sure you use the same symbol for that statement wherever it appears. Because if you don't, that's when you're going to get all messed up. And so the point is to be consistent. Whatever, once you choose a symbol for a particular statement, use the same symbol throughout that discussion. So let's look at problem number 1. If Albania manages to free itself from Chinese influence, then both Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia will adopt more liberal policies. But Bulgaria will not adopt a more liberal policy. Therefore, Albania will not manage to free itself from Chinese influence. Okay, it says to use truth tables to determine the validity of these arguments, so we're going to stick with truth tables right now. So our first problem is to write this argument in symbolic form. Okay? Now, I would suggest when you use a symbol that is maybe a letter that begins a key word in the statement somehow, so that you can have some sort of an association in your mind with that. For Albania, you know, you probably wouldn't want to use X or something. It might be easier to use A. And for Czechoslovakia, C. And for Bulgaria, B, for example. And so let's do it this way. Let's say, first of all, let's say A equals Albania manages to free itself from Chinese influence. That's the whole statement. See, each one of these symbols is going to represent a statement, not just a word. It's going to represent a proposition. We're talking about propositions now. So A represents the proposition that Albania manages to free itself from Chinese influence. Okay? And now let's, and you can choose any symbol you want here, but what other symbol would you choose here, looking at these other statements? Right, exactly. That's the way I would do it. I would say B equals Bulgaria will adopt more liberal policies. And C will say Czechoslovakia will adopt more liberal policies. Okay. Now, with those symbols, we can construct this argument. Okay, now, using those symbols, what's going to be my first premise? How am I going to symbolize that? Anybody want to volunteer that? Daryl?
The A horseshoe, principles, B and C.
Right. Okay. So let's see what that statement's going to say then. A is Albania manages to free itself from Chinese influence. What I'm saying is, if Albania manages to free itself from Chinese influence, then, horseshoe, B and C, Bulgaria will adopt more liberal policies and Czechoslovakia will adopt more liberal policies. Or I could just say both Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia will adopt more liberal policies. That's just shortening the language down. And in English, you could. That's one thing you need to watch is watch. In language, we don't repeat the whole statement. We'll just conjoin the two nouns or whatever that are making the statements, and so watch for those. But there's really two statements here. Both Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia will adopt more liberal policies. Well, that's what our first statement is. If Albania manages to free itself from Chinese influence, then both Bulgaria and Czechoslovakia will adopt more liberal policies. So that's our first premise. A, horseshoe, B, dot, C. Good. Any questions on this now before we go on? Anybody fail to see how we got that? It's just putting in symbolic logic in these terms, the symbol that we find there. See, we find an if-then. That's the thing that tips you off. If-then. So you know you're going to deal with a horseshoe symbol. That's what horseshoe symbol means. If-then. So if, in the if part of the antecedent is this statement, Albania manages to free itself from Chinese influence, and then the conclusion is B and C, both B and C. So we put this together symbolically like this, A horseshoe, B dot C. Okay, what's our next premise? Okay, right. But Bulgaria will not adopt a more liberal policy. Now, B said Bulgaria will adopt a more liberal policy, and so Bulgaria will not adopt a more liberal policy is not B. Okay, and again, watch for these, because watch for the wills and will not. Read your statement carefully, because sometimes if you don't recognize that it's been negated, you might make a mistake. And if your statement starts out in the negative, for example, if our statement, the original statement was Bulgaria will not adopt more liberal policies, and then later it said Bulgaria will adopt more liberal policies, then the will is going to be the, is going to be not be. You see, in other words, it's simply the negation of whatever statement was before. If it was a negative statement, it's going to be a positive statement, vice versa. But in this case, our original statement was B represents the statement that Bulgaria will adopt more liberal policies, but not B then would be Bulgaria will not adopt more liberal policies. That's our next premise. Okay, and then what's the conclusion of the argument? Okay, therefore Albania will not manage to free itself from Chinese influence, which would be not A, wouldn't it? So, therefore, not A. Okay, now what we want to do is see if this is a valid argument. Okay, now let's see, I wish we had more blackboard here, but we'll erase this. Maybe I can do it over here. One thing it might be best to do each time you do this is we use capital letters to represent specific statements. And now what we want to do is look at the general form of this argument and get it back into variables like P and Q. You can do it without doing that. You can just put A's and B's and so forth in your truth table and figure it out. But it's good when you get real complex arguments to put it back into the forms that you see in your rules here so you can identify them real quickly. Because when you're going through your rules, it's easier to identify them with the symbols that are used here than with the other symbols that you find. So this is exactly the same as the form of the argument P, horseshoe, Q, dot, R, not Q, therefore not P. Okay, you can see that's the same argument here. I just substituted P for A, Q for B, and R for C, and then consistently following that through, this becomes not Q and that becomes not P. That's just the same argument. So this is the form. This is the specific form of this argument. Specific form is this. Okay. Now let's make a truth table and find out if this holds. Now, the first thing I know about my truth table is what? How many lines am I going to have in my truth table?
Eight.
Right. I know I'm going to have 8 lines. Why? Because I've got 3 separate variables. I've got a P, Q, and R. And that's going to determine how many lines I'm going to have. Okay, I guess I'm going to take the full board here. Don't forget what it is. Okay, so I make a truth table. P, Q, R. Okay. And then we're going to use symbols. So I think these ones and zeros might even be better. This book happens to use T's and F's, but like Marco Six suggesting yesterday, a lot of the books will use ones and zeros, and they're easier to see quickly what's true or false, because T's and F's often look so much alike. You've got to really strain your eyes and so forth. So in this column, I'm going to put 1, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. Because I have 8 lines, and the first line I just put, I just split it in two, and the first half is true and the last half is false. This one I alternate this way. This is just by convention. These things you can put down without knowing anything else, just by the way that we set it up. It's simply trying to get all the different possible combinations of the terms. Okay, now, the next thing that might be good to write in my truth table is Q dot R. So I'm trying to build this whole term as a premise, build this as another premise, and this is a conclusion, and then look through my argument and see that if every time I have these two true, I'm going to have this true, then that'll mean I have a valid argument. So I want to get this term eventually, so I'm going to start with this. Q and R, okay, Q dot R is going to be true when they're both true. So it's 1 here, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0. Okay? So it's only true when both are true. Now P horseshoe Q dot R What I'm going to do is look at this column and this column to write this, P horseshoe Q dot R. Now, I know what Q dot R is here, and I know what P is here, so I apply my horseshoe symbol here. So this is going to be a 1, it's going to be true. This is going to be 0, because the horseshoe is false when this is true and this is false, just following the rules. This is 0, this is 0, okay, and the rest of them are going to be 1, because P is false in either case. Okay, so that's that. Now, not Q. To get not Q, I just negate this. Wherever this is 1, I put a 0, vice versa. So this is going to be 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0. It's a line here. Okay, okay, this is a premise. This is the premise. And the conclusion was not P, so I'll put not P down. Not P will be 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay, now, this is the conclusion. And how am I going to show whether the argument is valid? The argument is valid if every time I have true premises, I have a true conclusion. So both premises must be true. Okay, this case it doesn't work. In this case, they're not both true. Okay, so I've only got two places here where both the premises are true, and lo and behold, the conclusion is true in both cases. Hence, this is a valid argument. If it were invalid, I'd have some place here with both ones here and a zero over here. That would show me it was invalid. If I could find one place like that, it would be invalid. But since I can't, every place that both premises are true, the conclusion is also true, I've shown that this is a valid argument. Now, usually when you're writing these out, it might be good to put lines, numbers of your lines here, so you would say the argument is valid by lines 7 and 8, because in 7 and 8 I find both premises true and the conclusion also true, and I couldn't find any place where it wasn't. Okay, any questions on that? We're out of time here, but we'll work with this some more. Next Wednesday, not next Wednesday, but the Wednesday after next, bring these sheets with you to class again. And we're going to work through some more of these arguments, maybe take some more of these ones and words. I think these ones, these story problem type ones, are the ones we're really trying to get at anyway. And we'll work with a few more of those. Feel free to work on these on your own if you've got time, if you want to do it. There's no formal assignment, but if you want to, go ahead and work with them and bring your conclusions with you to the class.
Yeah, I'm trying to say, well, is it better, like, with not me and not you, to work so your both premises and conclusions are at one end, or is it okay to...
It doesn't really matter. In other words, you can do this in any order you want. You could have put not P right here next. And the important thing, though, I like to do it in such a way that I get my two premises together and my conclusion next, because that way it's easier to see them. If you've got one premise over here, one premise over here, and a conclusion in the middle, then you find yourself, you know, looking down these columns to get both through. And you can do it either way, you know. It's just a matter of setting it up for convenience. So it's up to you which way you do it. But yeah. For number 5, okay, was that on page
4?
Okay, yeah. I didn't bring it with me today, but if I can show you. That
even better yet, do you have answers for all of Kofi's?
Yes, I do. I have all the, he gives answers to the starred ones. He doesn't give answers to the other ones. And so he gives me enough to check on. Let's see, that was my page.
They will, but they do not.
Therefore, I had to make up a valid argument. It's even a side check.
Otherwise, it's invalid.
I didn't know if I used the correct form.
Yes. Okay.
I think that's
I'm delighted with the first one, but sometimes I only feel it's just by chance.
Yeah, right. Let me see.
Four,
he uses the symbols M. Okay, this is the one. Okay. It's four
M,
meters.
Not M.
M. Therefore, therefore O horseshoe M.
O horseshoe M.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just have to figure out why.
Yeah, I think the reason it's O horseshoe M is the conclusion is, so if Oregon's water supply is greatly reduced, then Montana suffers a severe drought. So the conclusion is a conditional, too.
Okay.
And
look at it slowly again.
Yeah, and once you've got that, it'll work out.
Oh, honestly, I just found that a lot of people are having problems with this because they feel it's a contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
We have Bulgaria says they will, but then Bulgaria won't.
Uh-huh.
So, but okay, I told them that it's better if they read it, and Bulgaria does not adopt a more liberal. And then
okay,
then that makes all the sense.
Okay. Yeah, that's a little linguistic, you know, problem that can come in. And but yeah, that's not what they're meaning. That should have been to I see the point. Either they should do this or put will here, if Albania will manage to free itself, or something, put it all in the future, will adopt, and will, if they put it all in the same tense, then there would be no problem.
Yeah,
I see what the point is.
Yeah.
Remind me of that next time, and I'll point that out, because that's a little linguistic problem that isn't the real problem of the logic. But those little linguistic problems can turn out to be a real problem. You have to watch those in some cases, because you may assume something that's not warranted. And so, something worth considering. Good, thanks. Okay. Yeah. My following epistles classes used to be being late after teaching wild body, so. Okay. Yes, when you see and, it's almost always that way. Yeah. Sometimes you know, conjunction can be used by other, you know, other terms can show conjunction too, but
okay.
And is almost always written and.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, let's see here. My, my, my. Keith has got his pulpit up there.